So I would like to welcome you today, this morning at the University of Bern. It's a great pleasure to have a full auditorium of very enthusiastic free software and creators. So I have to take care a little bit. My name is Matthias Stürmer. I'm member of the Swiss Free Systems User Group. The slide. We have also, yeah, you can see.
Now it's good. Notice they use the term that's used by people who don't want to raise it as an ethical issue, which I never use.
So today we are the Swiss Free Systems User Group. It's a non-profit association which tends to foster free software and open standards in Switzerland. We were founded in 1982, about a year before the GPL was started. So we have several initiatives, a parliamentarian group which does political enhancements for digital sustainability. We produced free software white paper, Ubuntu Swiss Remix DVD, we have a company directory and some other initiatives. We have also an event starting on 24th and 25th of March in Bern. It's the Free Expo, and you're very welcome to join the event. We have also Free Software in Schools conference in May. We have a free source, free software forum in September, and we have a free business lunch in Alonso Free. So, and yeah, please check our flyer. Now I would like to hand over to Nico, who is presenting Choose, the other organization.
Hi there, I'm Nico Schwartz. I'm a member of Choose, which is a subgroup that is a special interest group of the Swiss Informatics Society. We are the part dedicated to open-oriented system and systems and environments. Choose was founded in 1990, and we run the annual Choose Forum on a current theme in 2009 that was human-centric software development. And we run ad hoc events throughout the year. So this is one of our... we do student sponsorings, we do conferences and exchanges, and this is one of these Choose events. We have plenty of them throughout the year, but though most of them are, I think, a little bit smaller. And I'd like to hand over to Wilf, who will greet Richard someone.
Well, Richard, it's a great privilege and an honor to officially welcome you to Bern, to the Canton of Bern. I'm a member of the Canton Parliament here in Bern. And to tell you the truth, I was totally unaware of this Bernese agreement that seemed to have such an impact on how we handle copyrights today. And I think it's high time that you came to Bern to challenge us on that. You and I live in totally different worlds. We have perhaps a few things in common. I realized that you mainly work with men. I also work a lot with men's groups. Another thing is that we both have an interest in policy making. And when I think of good policies, of good lawmaking, then justice, sustainability, and also prosperity are two things that I try to follow. And I realized in reading about you that these were key words that I found in some of your writings. And you personally inspired me to actually a personal action. in that 15 years ago, I started as a sexual therapist together with my wife to invite a couple from the United States to come here to hold seminars. After a few years, we started to hold these same seminars ourselves. They offered us their material for free, handbook, PowerPoint presentations, and so on.
Oh, see,
I'm here to learn, you see, so anyway, we developed that seminar further and reached around 4,000 people with that, and just recently a couple came up to me and asked, could we use your seminar, and how can we handle this with the copyright? And I had no solution until I started to read about this Creative Commons license, and it inspired me to actually publish our material under a Creative Commons license.
Which Creative Commons license did you use?
I think it's the number 6 that I found, or 5.
There are 2 Creative Commons licenses which are free.
Okay.
Those are the Creative Commons Attribution License and the Creative Commons Attribution Share-alike license.
I think it's a share-alike that I felt would be most appropriate.
But the point is, the other 4 Creative Commons licenses are not free.
Mm-hmm.
And since this is an educational work, it should be free. I'll be talking about that.
Okay. Very good. Anyway, you can see you've already inspired me without even starting to talk. So I'm here with great expectations. It is, very definitely. So welcome Richard Stallman to the city of Bern.
Uh-oh. I feel it starting to pull me up again.
Richard Stallman has launched the development of the GNU operating system. GNU is free software. It runs on tens of millions of computers. He's won for his efforts to protect the public and the uses of software and the public in the terms of copyright laws. He's received plenty of awards. Among them was the ACM Grasshopper Award, the MacArthur Foundation Fellowship. the Taquito Award for Social and Economic Betterment, plus several honorary doctorates, to make sense of how serious he takes his dedication. There's an interview in The Setup where he says that his dream computer is his computer is a Limout Yilong with a Longsen chip and a 9-inch display, which is completely free.
Actually, now I have one with a 10-inch display. It's the newer model.
He was then asked what his dream setup might be, and he said, I would ideally like to have a machine with the speed and memory of a laptop, and the display size of a laptop, too, combined with the same freedom that I now have on my Yilong. And John Gruber, the tech blogger, responds to that. You can say what you want about him, but he walks the walk. The least thing you can say about him is that he makes a very consistent argument, and whatever he does, I give to you Richard Stallman.
Trying to think of where's the best place for me to stand and be visible and not be squished in between all these things. maybe here. This is not a talk about free software. This talk responds to a question people sometimes have asked me at the end of a talk about free software. So I better start with a brief introduction about free software so you'll know why people would ask me that question. Free software means software that respects the user's freedom and the social solidarity of the user's community. So the key values are freedom and social solidarity, which for me are more important than practical convenience. And specifically, A program is free software if you, the user, have these four essential freedoms. Freedom zero is the freedom to run the program as you wish. Freedom one is the freedom to study the source code and change it to make the program do what you wish. Freedom two is the freedom to help other people, which is the freedom to redistribute exact copies of the program. And freedom three is the freedom to contribute to your community, which is the freedom to distribute copies of your modified versions. So supposing you exercised freedom one, you have a modified version. Freedom three is you have the freedom to publish that or distribute it to other people when you wish. So we all know that computers do what humans tell them to do. They don't just have minds of their own. But which humans tell your computer what to do? Do you think it's you? Well, if you're using only free software, then yes, you are in control. But if you're using any non-free software, proprietary software, that means the developer of that program controls what your computer can do and what it can't do. And that's power. Unjust power that no one should ever have. And that power tempts them constantly to commit abuses, which is why they shouldn't have that power, right? If they were superhuman ethically, maybe we could just trust them. Except that even so, they're busy thinking about those users, and they can't think about your needs. So even then, you still need to have the freedom to do things to change the program to be good for you. Well, maybe if the developers of these programs were all omnipotent, omniscient, and omnibenevolent, maybe then we could just accept their software and say thank you. But such beings don't exist, so they're human. And they're tempted to use their power against you. It's very common to find malicious features in proprietary software that do things like spy on the user, restrict the user. They even have back doors that attack the user. For instance, one proprietary program that has all three is called Microsoft Windows. The spy features send information about details of what's been done on the computer. People don't see that, but a few people were clever and investigated. Then the restrictions users will notice. These are known as digital handcuffs or digital restrictions management, DRM, designed to restrict what the user can do with her own files in her own computer. And then the back doors allow Microsoft to do things like forcibly change the software at any time without asking permission of the nominal owner of the computer. So really, if computer has Windows running in it, Microsoft has owned that computer. Any malicious thing that's not in Windows today could be forcibly installed tomorrow. Then there's another backdoor for the use of the police in many different countries. And as far as I know, the police in any of those countries could enter the computer at any time. They may need to get a court order to get permission. But the spy agencies of all those countries presumably have it too, and they won't bother getting permission. And then there are all the unauthorized people that have copies, because it is being circulated, and they may be criminals, so it doesn't matter to them if they committed one additional crime by entering a computer with this program. So we know that Windows security is bad, but actually Windows security is zero against Microsoft and against whoever's got a copy of that program. So that's one example. Apple products such as the Macintosh and the iGrown and the iBed have digital handcuffs. and the iGrown and the iBed have a back door that lets Apple forcibly change the software, and Apple can even veto the installation of applications, which Windows doesn't do. But that's the next wave in total power over the user. The user's not allowed to do anything with his computer that hasn't been approved. And then there's the Amazon swindle, officially called the Kindle. Kindle means to start a fire. This so-called e-book reader is actually meant to burn our books. It's designed, like all the e-book readers, to take away the traditional freedoms of book readers, to do things like lend a book to your friend, or borrow it from the public library, sell it to a used bookstore, give it to a friend, buy it anonymously by paying cash, and even the freedom to keep the book for as long as you wish and read it as many times as you wish. They're trying to take away from us, and e-books are how they do it. So with the swindle, the only place to buy a book that isn't very old is from Amazon. And Amazon requires users to identify themselves. So Amazon has a list of all the books everybody has bought. This list must not be allowed to exist anywhere. It's too dangerous. There is no one in the world we could trust to have that list. There's no need to even raise the question of whether Amazon is sufficiently trustworthy, because automatically no one is. We don't have to evaluate Amazon's conduct individually. And then the digital handcuffs in the product stop people from lending, giving, and selling their books. And then as far as the freedom to keep your book as long as you wish, there's a back door to take care of that. We found out about the back door when Amazon used it. Amazon remotely erased all the copies of a particular book that people had bought directly from Amazon. These were the authorized copies. If there were any unauthorized copies, if people managed to make any, despite the digital handcuffs, they may have survived. It was the authorized copies that Amazon was able to erase. And of course, it knew exactly where they were. And the book that it used to demonstrate the Orwellian nature of this product was 1984 by George Orwell. A book that all of you should read. Before they erase it. So, malicious features in widely used proprietary software is normal. And this is a consequence of the fact that the developer has power over the users. But with free software, nobody has power over anybody else. The users have freedom to help themselves and to help each other. They're free to change the program for their own needs. They're free to pay somebody else to do it for them, which is good if you have a business but you don't know how to program. And they're also free just to help each other whenever they wish. So the aim of the free software movement is all software should be free. A non-free program is an injustice that we shouldn't stand for. And so I decided to develop a free operating system to make a way to use computers and have freedom. These are the ideas of the free software movement. So when you meet people who promote open source, The reason that term was invented was there were people in the free software community who used free software, and some of them contributed to free software, but they didn't want to talk about these political ideas. They didn't want to say this is a matter of freedom. So they invented another term they could use, which doesn't allude to freedom at all. Thank you. And then they constructed a different discourse connected with that term. And the ideas of freedom and social solidarity have been carefully excluded. That's why it makes a difference which term you use. And that's why I ask CH Open to please start talking about the ethics and become a free software organization. Like CH Libre. But if this were a free software talk, I would go on to explain the reasons why these four freedoms are needed and the history of developing the GNU plus Linux operating system and how there are now hundreds of different distributions of GNU plus Linux, and most of them actually contain proprietary software. There are just a few that are 100% free software. And those are the only ones that I'll endorse. You can find the list in gnu.org/distros. The well-known distros, sad to say, contain or suggest proprietary software, and that's not good. But this is not a talk about free software. This talk responds to a question people sometimes ask me at the end of such a talk. They ask, these ideas of free software, did they apply to other things too? Like hardware? Now that's a silly question. Let's look at applying the same four freedoms. After all, if the question is, does the same concept of freedom, does the same issue apply to physical objects like this microphone, that means the same four freedoms, or at least that we better start there. So let's see if they make sense for a physical object. There's freedom zero, which is the freedom to run the program as you wish. And for the physical object, that would be the freedom to use the object as you wish. And yes, you do have that freedom. Whoever sells you this product doesn't put on a license saying what you can or can't do with the object. Of course, there's certain things that are illegal to do at all, but that's a totally different issue. So, yes, you have freedom zero. What about freedom one, the freedom to study and change the source code of the program to make the program do what you wish? Well, here we run into a difficulty that the physical object doesn't have source code, at least not normally today. So we have to adapt freedom one. It could be the freedom to study and change the object. Even if there may be plans for the physical object, a design, a drawing, whatever, but we don't have something we can't just edit the drawing and then say compile it into a physical object. Maybe someday we will. So now we have to adapt freedom one to the freedom to study and change the object. And you have that freedom almost always, except that the ability to carry it out can be limited. Like, it would be rather hard to modify this microphone in any non-trivial way. The only part that would be easy to change is the string. The circuitry is almost certainly made up of chips that there's no way to modify. Now, maybe you could solder another wire onto the circuit board, but since most of the circuitry is inside the chips, it's probably limited what you could manage to do that way. So, we have freedom zero, we have freedom one, but it's practically limited. Freedom two is the freedom to make more copies and redistribute them to others. Well, there are no copiers for microphones. So, freedom two is just a completely meaningless question for most physical objects. And likewise, freedom three. Suppose you did change the string on this microphone, there's still no copier. So, the answer is, this question only makes sense to a limited degree for physical objects, and to that degree, you do have freedom. So, it wouldn't be a very interesting topic. That's why they ask about hardware, because it's a silly question. But there are some other things for which it's a very meaningful and real question, namely other works made up of information that you might have a copy of. Because we do have copiers for them. We do have ways to modify them. We can do that with our computers. And therefore, whether we are free to do so is an important question that affects us all every day. Now, if you have a copy of something that's not software, normally the only thing that affects your freedom to do so is copyright law. It's not totally true. They're starting to claim to put licenses on copies of things. And you should never accept a copy of anything published that has such a license on it. But mainly it's copyright law that restricts them. That's not the case for software. It's mainly contracts and withholding the source code that are used to restrict what people do with their copies of software. In any case, and by the way, it would be very good to adopt a law forbidding the sale of copies of any published work with any kind of contractual restrictions on the buyer. So, the question, aside from that, can be restated as, what should copyright law say about what we can do with our copies of published works? And to think about that, it's interesting to look at the history of copyright law, which is connected with the history of copying technology. Now, a change in technology can't affect basic moral questions. Those are too deep to be reached by a change in technology. But when we apply our principles to a specific question, we do it by looking at the consequences of our possible actions. And a change in the context can alter the consequences, and they can make the same action become more good or more bad. For instance, if we could reliably resurrect the dead, murder wouldn't be very serious. The judge would say, you killed him, you have to pay for his new body. In the U.S., most of us would need to pay for uninsured murderer insurance. But in civilized countries, the national health care system would take care of it. So, let's look at the history of copying technology. Copying began in the ancient world, where you did it by reading one copy and writing another. Now, this system was rather inefficient. It had certain other consequences, characteristics too. First of all, it had no economy of scale. To make 10 copies would take you 10 times as long as making one copy. Well, maybe a little less, because you'd have a learning curve. But another characteristic is it didn't require any equipment other than the equipment for reading and writing. Basically, they didn't have eyeglasses then, so it was the equipment for writing. And it didn't require any skill except literacy itself. The copying itself had no other skill that it required. The result was copies were made in a decentralized way. Anywhere somebody had one copy and wanted another, that person would copy it or have it copied. There was nothing like copyright in the ancient world. If you had a book and you wanted to copy it, no one would try to stop you, except if the local prince didn't like what the book said, in which case he might do all sorts of horrible things to you. But those were not exactly copyright. Those were something closely related, namely censorship. But then there was a big advance in copying technology, the printing press. The printing press made copying a lot more efficient, but not uniformly so, because the printing press made mass production copying much more efficient and did no good at all for making one copy at a time. And the reason is that the printing press has an economy of scale. It takes a lot of work to set the type. But once you've done that, you can make many copies much faster than you could write them. However, setting the type was slower than writing a copy, so if you wanted to make one copy, writing it by hand was still the most efficient way. Another fact about the printing press was that the press and the type were expensive, specialized equipment that most literate people didn't own. And using them required special skill that most literate people didn't know. The result was a centralized production of copies. Copies of any given book would be made in a few places, and then they would be transported to wherever people might want to buy them. During the first few centuries of printing, a lot of copies were still made by hand, either for very rich people to show how rich they were, or by poor people, because as the song goes, time ain't money if all you got is time. So these people couldn't afford printed copies, which were much cheaper than handwritten copies in general, but still fairly expensive. And they did have time available to write a copy themselves, so they did. Copyright began in the age of the printing press. And it functioned effectively as an industrial regulation on publishers, controlled by the authors and for the sake of the public. Because it operated as an industrial regulation, nobody tried to enforce it on all those poor people who were writing copies by hand. It was understood to, and it often explicitly said, that it applied to printing and publishing. It would have been silly and pointless to try to stop people from copying by hand. Because it operated as an industrial regulation, it was uncontroversial, easy to enforce, and arguably beneficial for the public. It was uncontroversial because the readers not being restricted by it at anything they could do, they had no reason to complain. It was easy to enforce because it only had to be enforced against publishers. And it's easy to find out who's publishing a book. You go to a bookstore and you say, where did these copies come from? There's no need to invade everybody's home and everybody's computer to do that. And it was arguably beneficial because notionally, the public, the readers, trade away part of their natural rights, namely their right to copy whatever they like and write whatever they like. But since they didn't have printing presses, they weren't in a position to publish these things anyway. So they weren't really losing anything in practical terms. And in exchange for trading that away, they got benefits, real benefits, the benefits of encouraging more writing, which they were in a position then to read. So if you have something that you can't use, and you trade it, and in exchange you get something of some value to you, at least it's a positive trade. Whether it's the best deal you could have got is another question, but at least it's positive. So the copyright system in the age of the printing press was arguably beneficial. But the age of the printing press is gradually giving way to another advance in copying technology, the age to the use of digital technology and computer networks. Another advance that makes copying more efficient, and again, not uniformly more efficient. Because here's what we had in the age of the printing press: mass production copying far more efficient than one-off copying. Well, digital technology gives us something like this. Because the main benefit is for, the bigger benefit is for one-off copying. And mass production copying benefits too, but they end up much closer together. For instance, they're not exactly equal. You know, mass-produced CDs are still cheaper and they're more robust than one-off CDs. But writing your own CDs is cheap enough that hundreds of millions of people can do it. So we're in a situation now more like the ancient world in which copyright made no sense. We're in a situation now where the freedom we couldn't exercise before in the age of the printing press, because we didn't have presses, we can now. And we want to. So what would a democratic government do? It would reduce the power that copyright law gives to copyright holders and give us back the freedom that we want. We can measure the lack of democracy in today's world by the tendency of governments to do the exact opposite. They are increasing copyright power as never before. So, in effect, copyright has become a restriction on the readers, controlled by the publishers in the name, and usually only in the name, of the authors. And a system that in its current form is intolerable. And making it even more intolerable is what most governments are about. Evidently, although they may have be democratic in form, really they are satraps of the empire of the businesses. So what are they doing? They're extending copyright power in every possible way. One way is how long copyright lasts, which has been extended in many places. The Berne Convention, which we're going to protest this afternoon, requires copyright to be ridiculously long. It has to last till 50 years after the author dies. No, what? Oh, is it 70? No, I thought it was, in Europe it's 70, but I think that's because it goes beyond the Berne Convention. You see, it gets extended and extended. The U.S. extended copyright by 20 additional years in 1998. You see, it used to be that in the U.S., copyright on an individual work lasted for the 50 years after the author died, but in Europe it was 70 years. Whereas in both places, for a work made for hire, it lasted 75 years. And then they said, we need to harmonize with Europe. So they extended them both by 20 years. Which means that now in the U.S., a work made for hire has 95 years of copyright. So I'm sure in Europe they're going to start saying we have to extend the copyright on, again to harmonize with the U.S. And that way they'll just shift the imbalance back to the individual works. And then the U.S. will be able to harmonize again. I don't know why they don't consider harmonizing down. So the U.S. extended copyright on both past and future works. I don't understand how extending copyright on past works is supposed to create more incentive for the now probably dead authors back in the 20s and 30s to write more. it would require a time machine. And if they have a time machine, they haven't bothered to use it. Because our history books don't say that there was a big boost for writing and art in the 1920s when authors discovered that their copyrights would be extended in 1998. Now, it is notionally possible that 20 more years of copyright on future works would motivate people to make more of them, but not if they're rational. Because the discounted present value of 20 more years of copyright so far in the future is too small to motivate anybody. So the real reason why various companies purchased that law, and that's how laws are made in the US, they're purchased usually by businesses. The motive was these companies had lucrative monopolies which were going to expire. For instance, Disney knew that the copyright on the first film in which Mickey Mouse appeared was going to expire in a few years. And when that happened, it would become legal for anyone else to draw that character inside their works. And Disney gets a lot from the public domain and is determined never to contribute anything to it. So Disney paid for this law, and probably some other companies paid for this law. We call it the Mickey Mouse Copyright Act. Now, the movie companies say that they want perpetual copyright. But in the US, that would be unconstitutional. So instead, they've worked out a scheme to get the same result without admitting it. It's been referred to as perpetual copyright on the installment plan. Every 20 years, they extend copyright by 20 more years, with the effect that nothing will ever go into the public domain again. Well, that's one dimension, the dimension of time. There's also the dimension of breadth. Which activities does copyright restrict? In the age of the printing press, copyright was not supposed to restrict all uses of a copyrighted work. Copyright restricted certain uses, which were exceptions within a broader space of freedom. But the publishers see in digital technology the opportunity to seize total power. And that's what they are doing with digital restrictions management. The first place that the public encountered DRM was in DVDs. The movie in a DVD is stored in an encrypted format that initially was secret. And the purpose of this format and keeping it secret was to restrict all users. The conspiracy that established the DVD format required all manufacturers of DVD players to commit to restricting the public in the same ways, which means that effectively there is no competition. Now, initially it was a secret, but then some people figured out the format and developed and released a free program that can play the movie in a DVD. Well, this program is legally censored in the US, in the European Union. I don't know whether it's censored in Switzerland. Does anyone here know? Not yet. Well, you've got to fight to preserve that freedom. Because the US and the EU are trying to bully all the rest of the world into joining in this system of censorship. The publishers are really aiming to create a pay-per-view universe. they want to get rid of all technology we could use to escape that we could use to break the digital handcuffs. And that's what the laws forbid. They censor any software that can break digital handcuffs. However, the movie companies realize that they can't make that software go away. It keeps circulating. It's not hard to get. So they developed another form of digital handcuffs known as AACS. And they thought that that would never be broken. It's used in HD DVD discs and in Blu-ray discs. And then a few years ago, someone released a program that could decrypt it, but the program was legal because it was useless, because in order to actually use it, you'd need the key. And then I saw a photo of two adorable little puppies, and above them were 32 hex digits. And I wondered, why would anyone put together these hex digits and those puppies? I wonder if these digits are a key that governments are going to try to suppress. And they put them together with the puppies because people liking the puppies would share copies of the photo and thus preserve the key. And that's what it was. That was the key necessary to take the axe to AACS. It was posted on Dig and the editors of Dig, as obedient servants of the empire, erased it. And it was posted again, and they erased it. And after it had been posted hundreds of times, they said, "We give up." After a couple of weeks, this was on 700,000 web pages. So it was an outpouring of resistance to the empire of these businesses. But that doesn't mean we have defeated that system, because they changed the key. So and meanwhile, Blu-ray has another level of DRM. It has been cracked as well, but I don't know if there's any free software that can do it. Does anyone here know of any free software that can be used to break the handcuffs on a Blu-ray disc? Do not use Blu-ray discs, because you must never accept any product designed to attack your freedom unless you personally have the means to defeat the attack. So it's okay to use, to own or rent or accept as gifts, DVDs if you have the free software that breaks the digital handcuffs in the DVD. Otherwise, you shouldn't. I don't have a copy of that program. I just don't have or use any encrypted DVDs. I'm happy with that solution. And part of the reason is I sometimes go to France. In France, you can be imprisoned for possessing a copy of this program. That shows how eager President Sarkoma is to attack people on behalf of these companies. Now, both of these systems of digital handcuffs illustrate something interesting. Almost always, they are designed by conspiracies of companies. It's very rare that one company by itself is in a position to do this. So, the conspiracy involves hardware manufacturers and computer manufacturers and movie companies and these are conspiracies to restrict the public's access to technology. Such conspiracy should be a crime. The executives of those companies should have been tried and imprisoned for what they've done. But they are not worried that this will happen, because they know that almost all governments are on their side against the citizens. They don't even bother to hide their conspiracies. which is how I know about them. I'm not an investigator. If these conspiracies were secret, I wouldn't be sure they existed. But they're not secret. They have websites. For instance, I looked at the website of AACS, where at the time were stated some of the rules that they imposed on manufacturers. For instance, starting in 2011, analog video outputs were going to be prohibited. The reason is they say they want to close the analog hole. I can show you a couple of analog holes here that they want to close. The website also listed the companies that had sponsored the conspiracy. They included Intel, AMD, Microsoft, Sony, Philips. I think Apple was one of them too. They're all working together to take away our freedom. So, that's the situation with video. But we've met digital handcuffs also in music. Starting around 10 years ago, we saw things that looked like compact discs, but they were not written following the standards of compact discs. So we called them corrupt discs. The purpose of them was to be impossible to read in a computer. Some European countries say that because they don't follow the standard, they have to they can't use the compact disc logo. They have a different symbol that says copy control, which is good because that way you can avoid buying them. So I once gave a speech like this in Spain. I had been invited by part of the regional government, and afterwards, as they tend to do, they gave me some books with pictures of some of the beauty of their region and some discs of music from their region. And I wanted to listen to one, but fortunately, I saw before opening the packet the symbol copy control. This disc can be played on Windows and Macintosh systems. In other words, only with proprietary software. So I gave it back and I said, "Here you see the face of the enemy. Please give this back to the store because they shouldn't be able to keep your money." And I've never heard that music, and maybe I never will. But occasionally freedom requires a sacrifice, and that's a pretty small one. Now, we've also seen, then there was the scheme that Sony used for corrupt discs, where if you stick the disc in a computer, it would install software into the system, breaking the security of your computer. And then this software was known as a rootkit. It's like the thing that a virus might use to take control, or that a cracker trying to invade the machine might use if it isn't Microsoft invading the security of a Windows machine, because Microsoft can do that automatically. And this software also modified some commands to disguise its presence in the machine. And it modified another command to make it difficult to delete this software. Now, all this is a felony in most countries, I think. But it's not the only one Sony committed, because this software also included free software that had been released under the GNU GPL, and Sony did not comply with the conditions, which include providing source code for the whole of the software, of the program containing that code, and a copy of the GPL to inform users of the four freedoms. So that's commercial scale copyright infringement, which is also a felony. Of course, Sony was not prosecuted, because the governments understand that the purpose of copyright law is to subject us to the companies, not to restrict them. But people did sue Sony. Unfortunately, they focused their condemnation not on the malicious purpose of all this, which was to restrict us all, but rather on the other secondary evil things that Sony did as part of the mechanism. So Sony was able to settle the suit by promising that in the future they wouldn't put rootkits on their discs of music. In the future, the rootkit is to be included in the product before you get it and will be impossible to remove, as is the case, and it implements AACS. And this is the case in the PlayStation 3, which is an extremely malicious product. Nobody has ever found a way to break the DRM of that, so no one should get it. There's just one redeeming quality about these particular corrupt disks, which is if you're not running Windows, they wouldn't bother you because the software that they try to install is only designed for Windows. And even Windows users could protect themselves if they remembered always to hold down a certain key when putting in those disks. Of course, it's hard to avoid ever forgetting to do something, so that's not much of a very safe solution. The safe solution is defenestrate your computer. So, we also have seen DRM on downloaded music, which is a different form of malice. But fortunately, DRM is sort of going away in music for the most part. So in that theater, we seem to be winning this war. I'm told it happened because the record companies made deals with Apple and then saw that those deals had given Apple too much power, and that the only way that they could escape from those deals was to start distributing music without DRM. So if Apple did anything good, it was not intentionally. But now we're starting to see an attempt to impose DRM on books. That's what ebooks are for, as I explained before. That they tried that 10 years ago. And there was a company that thought that they could kickstart their line of DRM-restricted ebooks with a biography of me. So a writer came to me and asked if I would cooperate, and I said, no, this book has to be published without encryption. So the publisher wouldn't agree to that, and I stood by my position. I'm good at being at least as stubborn as somebody else. And eventually, we found another publisher who was willing to publish it without encryption and even publish it under a free license. So the book was published and sold a lot of copies on paper, even though the source code was available on the net to be downloaded. In fact, lots of people find that allowing downloads increases sales of printed books. But nonetheless, they're trying now to impose DRM on ebooks, and that's what products like the Amazon Swindle and the Sony Shredder are for. All along, ebooks failed a decade ago. They just didn't become popular. But I told people, this is surely not because people love their freedom too much. It's for some practical reason. They'll fix that and they'll try again. We've got to be ready for them. And now they are trying again. And they're trying to push it very hard. So make sure your friends think about the issue before they consider buying the product. Make sure they realize what they will be doing if they start using that. Imagine visiting your friend's house and there are no books. So you can't look at the shelves of books, and your friend can't possibly lend you a book, because the only way to lend you a book would be to lend you his whole library, and that's obviously too much to ask of anyone. So if we don't want that to be our world, we must reject these malicious products. Tell your friends about this before they buy one, so they'll understand and they won't buy one. So they'll understand it means, as readers, they won't have any friends anymore. So this is how governments are extending copyright power, by forbidding the software that can break the digital handcuffs, by censoring it. They support these conspiracies to restrict our access to technology and help the publishers in their campaign to impose a pay-per-view universe. But what should governments do? What would a democratic state do? It would reduce copyright power. Here's what I recommend. First, there's the dimension of time. I recommend that copyright should last for 10 years starting from the date of publication. Why starting from the date of publication? Because before the work is published, we don't have copies, so practically speaking, we are not feeling the restriction at all. We might as well let the author or artist have as long as it takes to arrange publication and start the period then with publication. Why do I propose 10 years? Because at least in some countries, at least in the US, the publication cycle lasts less than 3 years. Within 2 years, the book is remaindered, that is, the remaining copies are sold off at a lower price, and within 3 years, it's out of print. 10 years is more than three times as long, so it's got to be sufficient in almost all cases, and thus sufficient generally. But I'm not saying 10 years is exactly the right number. I propose it as a rough approximation. Maybe a first adjustment. And after a while, we could maybe make it a little longer or a little shorter. But I think this is roughly right. Not everyone agrees, however. I once proposed this on a panel discussion with fiction writers. And the prize-winning fantasy writer sitting next to me said, 10 years, that's intolerable. Anything more than 5 years is too much. Yeah, I was surprised too, because when the publishers demand increased power, they always say they're doing this for the authors or the artists, on behalf of them. And they bring out a few famous authors and artists who are very rich, among the few who become rich, who say, yes, we want more power. And so they lead us to think that the added power they're demanding is going to benefit the artists and authors generally. Well, that's not true. It's only the few exceptions that they bring out who are benefiting, the famous ones who are getting tremendous amounts of money. And the rest, the publishers are grinding into the ground with their heels. For instance, this person whose book had won an award but wasn't a bestseller. I later read it. It was good. In any case, he had a dispute with his publisher. You see, his publication contract said that if the book went out of print, the rights would revert to him. Well, his book was out of print for all practical purposes, since people couldn't get copies. He But the publisher refused to acknowledge this and was using the copyright on his own book to stop him from distributing copies of his own book, which he wanted to do so that people could read them. Because that's what an artist starts out wanting. I want to show my work to people and I want to see them appreciate it. And that's what most artists go on wanting. A few of them get a lot of money, which can corrupt them, and they start wanting the money more. Most artists don't get a chance to face this possible corruption. They never get very much money. So they continue wanting their work to be appreciated. He wanted his work to be appreciated, and copyright law was stopping him from showing people copies. He knew that more than 5 years of copyright was unlikely to ever do him any good. So he said, nothing more than 5 years. Well, I'm not necessarily against that. If there's a consensus that 5 years is better than 10, okay. But that's just one dimension. What about the dimension of breadth? We need to reduce the power of copyright too on this dimension. But I have different suggestions for different types of works. I distinguish three broad categories of works. There are the works of practical use, functional works, works that you use to do a job in your life. Then there are the works that say what certain people thought. And then there are the works of art whose contribution to society is in the impact of the work itself. And the difference between these two is, for the works that say what somebody thought, the name of the author is very important. For the works of art, it actually doesn't matter. It's the same work no matter who wrote it. So you may be curious who wrote it, but or it may be a recommendation, but it's not crucial. So, for these three categories, I have different recommendations. The works of practical use must be free. In this category, we find software and recipes for cooking and educational works and reference works and text fonts and patterns for sewing clothing and various other things that whose contribution to society is in being used to get a job done. And yes, you may look at the code of a program and say, how elegant or how ugly, but that's not what the program is for. You may look at the way a recipe is written and say, how elegant, but that's not what the recipe is for. The recipe is for cooking with. So, you must have the four freedoms, because if you don't control the work, then you don't control your life. You're using the work to do jobs in your life. To control your life, which is freedom, requires control of the work. But once you have adapted the work to do your job, it's important for society that you be free to publish your version, because there may be others who want to do the same job you're trying to do and for whom your version is useful. However, it makes no sense to permit publication of modified versions and forbid republication of unmodified copies, because that just makes people make changes that don't really affect anything, and it's just pointless. So we're led to the four freedoms. So if you have a recipe, you should be free to cook it as you wish, when you wish. You should be free to study the recipe and then change it so it makes the food you wish. You should be free to redistribute copies to other cooks. And you should be free, if you've changed the recipe, to distribute copies of your version to other cooks. And likewise for educational works and reference works and text fonts and so on. Somebody might conceivably try to object that if we don't give up our freedom and let publishers control our use of these works, the works won't be made. and then it will have a disaster. And 20 years ago, that argument might have seemed plausible, but today we know empirically it's not true. Look at all the free software we have. Look at all the recipes that are circulating and that cooks share freely, even if in some sense it's copyright infringement if they don't rewrite the recipe in different words. And then look at the free reference works, such as Wikipedia. And then there's starting to be free educational works also. So we know they're wrong. We shouldn't panic and give up our freedom. We should insist on our freedom. We should put an end to the non-free works in these categories. But what about the other categories? The works that say what certain people thought include, for instance, autobiographies, essays of opinion, scientific papers, offers to buy and sell. Now, to publish a modified version of these is to misrepresent someone. I see no reason why society should allow that. But there is a minimum, and as a consequence, there's no need to allow commercial republication either. But there's a minimum freedom that we must always have for any work that is published, and that is the freedom to non-commercially share exact copies. The attempt to stop that is what is making copyright tyrannical. It's the war on sharing, which requires draconian, nasty laws. And which is leading to disregard for fundamental principles of justice, like proposals to punish people without trial, requirements for people to monitor the others around them so that they'll be punished if they don't, essentially conscripting people into acting as copyright police. So we must grant the freedom to non-commercially redistribute exact copies of published works. And this will end the war on sharing. It will turn copyright back essentially into an industrial regulation that we can live with. So we will have a reduced copyright system, which covers commercial use and modification, but we'll all be free to redistribute exact copies non-commercially. This reduced copyright system will continue providing revenue to the authors and artists in more or less the same way it does now, the same inadequate way it does now. But then, what about works of art and entertainment, where the contribution is in the impact of the work itself? Here, the issue of modification is difficult because there are valid arguments on both sides. On one hand, the work can have an artistic integrity which a modified version can destroy. And we see proof of this frequently. We also see that lots of authors will permit the butchery of their works by Hollywood in exchange for enough money. So those authors may talk about artistic integrity sometimes, but they don't really have it. But there are some authors who make Hollywood stick to the book and not destroy it. They may have artistic integrity. But on the other hand, modifying an artistic work can be a contribution to art. Consider the folk process, by which a series of people will transform a work and can produce something very rich. But if we want to think only about named artists, consider Shakespeare. some of whose plays use stories copied from other works published just a few decades before. If today's copyright law had existed then, those plays would have been infringing and would never have been written. And the copyright holders would say it's a good thing because that would be a cheap ripoff. Why should we allow that? Since those plays were written, we can say that they're not cheap ripoffs, but only because we had the chance to see them. So, how to resolve this? It occurred to me eventually that someday the work is going to go into the public domain, and then people will be free to publish modified versions. The only question is, how soon? And it also occurred to me that with artistic works, although the modified version is can be a contribution to art, it's not urgent the way it is to publish your modified version of a practical, functional work. If copyright lasts 10 years, you can wait 10 years. So that's what I recommend. For 10 years, the reduced copyright system that covers commercial use and modification, but everyone will be free to redistribute exact copies. And then the copyright expires and people are free to publish their modified versions as further contributions to art. But there's another point to be made. There's a practice known as remix, where people take little bits out of lots of different works and put them together into a work that overall is totally different from all of them. That has to be legal, because the purpose of copyright is to promote the practice of art and other fields of writing. And so to have it obstruct the making of works is self-defeating. That would only happen if a country allows its legal system effectively to be hijacked and turned against its purpose. But that's what's happened. So remix just has to be legal. So these are my recommendations for what to do with copyright law. And in particular, this means sharing copies on the network must be legal. But the record companies will say, that's stealing money from the artists. Well, like most of what businesses say, it's less than a half truth. This happens to be more like a one-tenth truth. There are some artists who really do make money if you buy their records. Those are the long-established superstars when you're buying their records that were not among their first five or seven records that were their first contract. Because all the rest, they don't actually get any money if you buy their record. And the reason is that the production and publicity expenses are treated by the contract as an advance to the musicians, even though they didn't actually get that money. And so when you buy the record, a certain fraction, which is nominally or theoretically for these musicians, actually goes from one account in the record company to another to supposedly pay back that advance. It's very rare that a record sells enough to do that. Records can become platinum without finishing paying back the advance. So the way musicians really get their money is from concerts and from selling merchandise. Nowadays, the record companies are trying to take control of that too. So when I buy a commercial CD, I feel ashamed that I'm not supporting the musicians. So they can't lose what they don't get. So legalizing copying can't make them lose anything. It will just make the record companies lose, perhaps. And what about movies? We've heard that movies cost tremendous amounts to make. Could they possibly be made? Well, I heard from a producer that over half of those figures we hear is usually publicity, not the cost of actually making the movie. And even the other less than half is exaggerated by creative accounting, because that way the studio doesn't have to start paying the investors or paying taxes until it has more of the income. So they don't actually need as that much. And then some pretty good movies cost very little. Like there's Nasty Old People, which I saw a few weeks ago, which was made as an amateur project and released under one of the Creative Commons licenses, I don't know which. But there, I should point out, Creative Commons has 6 different licenses. 2 of them are free licenses, but all of them at least permit non-commercial sharing of exact copies. So for art, they're all okay, in my view. However, for educational works and reference works, and only the 2 that are free should be used. And those are the attribution license and the attribution share alike license. Those are the 2 that are free. Anyway, also consider that a lot of use of movies is commercial use, which my proposed reduced copyright system would still cover just the same as now. Like showing the movies in theaters, showing them in airplanes, showing them on TV. This is all commercial. So I'm pretty confident movies could still be made. We should also notice that nearly all of what Hollywood makes is crap for systematic reasons. It's not just because it's so hard to do a good job that they usually make a mistake. It's not just mistake. It's the system which pushes people in that direction. I read a book once called Save the Cat, which billed itself as a guide to how to write screenplays that would sell. But what I got from it was how the system works and pushes things in the direction of crap. For instance, it has to be describable in one sentence. If it doesn't have a one-sentence description that'll convince somebody to want to buy it, then it won't sell. Well, I don't believe in censorship. I'm against censorship of anything. Censorship is much more dangerous than anything that people might purport to censor. And I'm not in favor of censoring movies because I think they're crap. I'm not even in favor of censoring movies that are horribly disgusting, like Pulp Fiction, that I never want to see anything like that again. But I don't believe in censoring it. However, the question, nobody's proposing to censor it. The question is whether we should give up our freedom to help more of it be made, more crap be made. And that I'm not in favor of. So, legalizing sharing will not cause the disaster that the publishers like to predict. You can always expect any business that has procured favorable laws to predict that the sky will fall if they don't have those laws. And you can never believe them. Occasionally it's true, but you can't believe what they say about it. But on the other hand, we might want a system that supports artists adequately, unlike the current lousy system. So I have a couple of suggestions. One is through taxes. We could collect a special tax, say, on blank discs or internet connectivity, or just use the general budget the same as we use to support maintaining streets. But either way, the important thing is how to distribute the money. The money must be distributed entirely to artists. And based on their success, which we could measure through sampling and so on, there are various ways, polls to measure success of an artist, but not in linear proportion to their success. The reason is a superstar can have far, far more success than ordinarily successful artists. Suppose a superstar has a thousand times the success of fairly successful artist B. Well, in linear proportion, we would give A 1,000 times as much money as B, which means most of our money would be going to the superstars, and the tax money would be spent in an inefficient way in order to support most of the fairly successful artists adequately. We'd have to make the superstars tremendously rich. So what I propose is put in a function that looks like this, like maybe cube root. So this way, instead of getting 1,000 times as much money as B, would get 10 times as much money as B. And that way our system could support, most of the money would go to supporting the large number of fairly successful, fairly popular artists. And yes, each superstar would still get more than less popular artists, but the total amount going to the superstars would not be a big fraction of the money. This would be an efficient system. We could support the artist better with less money than we spend now. But some people have a bad reaction, a knee-jerk, hostile reaction to taxes. So I have another suggestion, which is voluntary payments. This is already starting to work. In fact, I saw an article mentioning a considerable number of musicians at different levels of popularity, not all superstars, who are now making money pretty well by selling various things associated with their music while they let the music be shared. So in effect, it's more or less like voluntary payments. And I bought a pre-downloaded DVD of the movie Sita Sings the Blues. I could have just downloaded it from Nina Paley's website, but I paid her for a pre-downloaded DVD because I wanted to support her. She's a genius. She made this movie almost entirely by herself, except with a few people who provided voices. And then she had to pay a lot of money to get permission to distribute it at all with the music that's in it. So she calls it getting it out of copyright jail. That music was from the 30s and 40s. So under my proposal, it would be in the public domain now. But anyway, voluntary payments work, but they have a drawback. It's not so easy to make them. And the systems for paying money are not very efficient. You need to have a credit card or have a bank account to get a PayPal account. And then PayPal will keep half of the money for small amounts, I believe. It's half. So if you wanted to send a small amount, like 1 franc, it would be ridiculous. But that's exactly what we have to make possible. So I recommend that every player should have a button on it to send maybe 1 franc here, 1 euro, $1, 1 rupee in India would be a good amount. But an amount appropriate to the country that most people could pay without really missing it. So the only reason you'd ever hesitate is because it's too much trouble. So with this button, we get rid of the trouble, and then there will be a lot more voluntary payments. And you could push it or not, right? So, but who here could not afford to give one franc this way every week. Well, if you can't afford it, you don't have to. We don't have to squeeze the money out of poor people to support the arts. There are enough people who are not poor, who can do it, who won't miss it. I think most of you wouldn't even miss it if you sent one franc every day. So these new methods would support the arts much better. And Francis Muguet developed a method that combines aspects of both of them and takes advantage of existing relationships so that it becomes easier to enact. It's called global patronage, or mécénat global. And here's how it works. Every internet subscriber has to pay a monthly fee to support the arts and has the right to apportion a certain fraction of that among the works of her choice. So that limit might be 30%. So if, let's assume it's 30%. Well, then she could say, I want to give 10% to that particular work and 5% to that work and 1% to each of those five, and I won't bother allocating beyond the other 10% I could allocate. So that means 20% of her payment is allocated and the other 80% is not. Well, the money that people allocate to specific works gets divided among the authors of those works according to the rules that already exist. And that not only provides money for those people, but it also provides a measure of popularity. And then the rest of the money gets divided based on that measure of popularity, but using the cube root, so that it supports more the people who are not so popular, but still somewhat popular. And the money actually passes from the ISP to the collecting society, which is required to pass it on to the members. So you put this together with a requirement to allow people to set up their own collecting societies as they wish, get rid of the monopoly, and then you have a system which follows the existing relationships and has the effect of supporting artists based on their success, but not in linear proportion. So I'd like to mention some websites. If you want more information about the GNU operating system, look at GNU.org. For instance, the list of totally free GNU plus Linux distros you can find in GNU.org/distros. And the philosophy you can find in GNU.org/philosophy. There's also FSF.org, the site of the Free Software Foundation, where you can order merchandise like these, order books and manuals. You can also join. You can also find their resources, like our free software directory and lists of hardware products that don't require proprietary software. You can also find our campaigns. For instance, we have a protest campaign against DRM called defectivebydesign.org. Please visit that site and sign up and participate in our protests. Most of them are done virtually over the net. You don't have to be physically present for them, which means you don't have to wait for a protest to be held here. There is also the Free Software Foundation of Europe at fsfeurope.org, and it also needs members. So take a look at them. And now it's time for the auction. I'm going to auction this adorable little GNU, which needs a home. And if you have a penguin, you must get a GNU, because as we all know, a penguin just can't hardly function without a GNU. So please get your penguin a GNU. And I can sign it if you are the one who wins it. So if you bid, please raise and wave your arm and shout out the number you are bidding. So I'm going to start with, and the money all goes to the Free Software Foundation to defend your freedom. So I'm going to start at 30 francs. Do I get 30 francs? Uh-oh, well, I think I saw you first. So, okay, so I've got 30. Do I get 35? I've got 35. Do I get 40? I've got 40. Please shout out the number when you bid. I've got 40. Do I get 45? I've got 45. Do I get 50? I've got 50. Do I get you? Do I get 55? I've got 55. Do I get 60? I've got 60. Do I get 65? I've got 65. Do I get 70? Do I get 70? I saw him first, so okay, I've got 70. Do I get 70? What? How much? Speak. I've got 80. Do I get 85? I've got 80. Do I get... I've got 85. Do I get 90? I've got 90. Do I get 95? What? I've got 100. Do I get 110? I see a hand up. Are you bidding 110? Speak, please. I've got 110. Do I get 120? I've got 120. Do I get 130? I've got 130. Do I get 140? I've got 130. Do I get 140? Do I get 140? Yes, we do. I've got 150. Do I get 160? I've got 150. Do I get 160? I've got 160. Do I get 170? Do I get 170? 170 francs to the Free Software... I can't hear you. How much? I've got 170. Do I get 180? Do I get 180? I've got 180, I think. What do... Speak. I've got 200. I've got 200. Do I get 220? I've got 200. Do I get 220? I've got two. How much? I've got 220. Do I get 240? What? I've got 250. I've got 250. Do I get 270? I've got 250. Do I get 270? I've got 250. Do I get 270? 270 francs to the Free Software Foundation to defend your freedom? I've got 270. Do I get 300? I've got 300. Do I get 330? I've got 300. Do I get 330? I've got 300. Do I get 330? 330 francs to the Free Software Foundation to defend your freedom. Do I get 330? Do I get 330? Last chance. I've got 330. Do I get 360? Do I get 360? I've got 330. Do I get 360? I've got 330. Do I get 360? Last chance to give 360 francs to defend your freedom. I've got 360. Do I get 400? I've got 360. Do I get 400? I've got 360. Do I get 400? 400 francs to the Free Software Foundation. Last chance. Do I get 400? Do I get 400? No, I don't want to advance so by such small fractions. Sorry. Do I get 400?
Do I get 400? What? Okay, I've got 400. Do I get 440? I've got 400. Do I get 440? I've got 400. Do I get 440? Last chance to contribute 440. Do I get 440? Going, gone for 400. So please come up. Please come up. So which way are you going to pay? Cash or credit card? Okay, get a piece of paper. There seems to be papers here. And, well, these are not blank. It's a bit unfortunate.
Or with invoice.
Yeah, what?
Invoice.
I can't hear you.
Invoice?
No, the point is you have to write down the credit card information on a piece of paper and show me both.
Sure.
And then I'll keep the piece of paper. Ah, here's paper. Okay. So write down all the information, you know, number and expiration date, name, code, and your email address and the amount, and say which currency, because otherwise they might get confused. No. That's not a published work. That's personal information, totally different information, different issue. So now it's time for questions. Ah, if we're going to use a microphone, please do it this way. No, don't bring the microphone to people. Stay here and keep the microphone, and people can make a line to ask questions. Believe me, this works much better.
So what do you think about source code that runs in a private data center, like in Google's data center?
Sorry, source code what in a private data center? I can't understand your words.
What do you think about... for example, Linux that runs at the Google data center that is modified but never republished.
Oh, well, okay, he's talking about Linux, the kernel that Torvalds wrote. People have a right to do that. That's part of the four freedoms. You know, freedom one is the freedom to study the source code and change it to make it do what you wish. And then freedom three is the freedom to redistribute copies of your version when you wish. But none of these four freedoms is an obligation. None of them is a requirement. It's the freedom to do things as you wish, not a demand that you do them. Now, there might be cases where I would say that for other reasons, some software you've developed would be such an important contribution to humanity that it's wrong for you to refuse to contribute it. But that's not part of the idea of free software.
The problem I see here is that if you create a software with a client...
There is no such thing as a software. The word software refers to a substance.
Okay, if you...
It's like poetry.
If you write a program that runs on a PC and that uses some GPL licensed library, then you have to open source it. But
No. I don't do open source. Open source is the term used by people who disagree with me. And that's not what the GPL requires. The GPL says that you have the freedom to distribute copies of your modified versions if you wish. And if you do, you have to distribute the entire modified program under the GPL. But it doesn't require you to distribute copies. I was very careful about this.
The problem there is if I'm a vendor of a software, I can engineer it in a way where the algorithm runs on a server, or I could engineer it in a way where the algorithm runs on the client's PCs.
But actually, it's wrong to do it on the server. That's software as a service, and people should never use software as a service, because if you use it, you lose control of your computing. It has the same harmful effect as using proprietary software. Except that it becomes even harder to study and change the program if you're using software as a service. With proprietary software, typically you get an executable and you don't get the source code. So to study it, you'd have to do reverse engineering, and then to change it, you'd have to patch this executable. That's hard, but it's theoretically possible. It's just so hard that people almost never do it. With software as a service, you don't get the source code and you don't get the executable, which means that you absolutely can't find out what it's really doing, and you can't possibly change it, and you should never use software as a service. Software as a service means that you send your data to another site to do computing for you, and it sends you back the results. Now, most of what you do with websites is not software as a service. Mostly it's publication or looking at others' publications, or it's communication, e-commerce. Those things are not software as a service, because what's happening is not your computing, except in a very trivial, foolish sense. So most websites this issue doesn't apply to, but where it does, for your freedom's sake, you must say no.
Okay, thank you. Next question.
You come and...
No.
Ah, well, there is actually a handout over here which explains, but there are three things about the Berne Convention that we are condemning. One is it requires copyright to last too long. Another is it imposes copyright on everything that's written or drawn or recorded. It basically, it's automatically copyrighted. And then the third problem is the very strict rules about exceptions to copyright that make it impossible to have the exceptions that people need. So basically, our freedom and the Berne Convention are on a collision course, and we have to make sure we win and not the Berne Convention. But anyway, if you want to shout, it's okay as long as I can hear you, but you may not get into the recording. But if you could come up, if you want, come up here and use the microphone. And one advantage is if you make a line, then you'll have your turn. It's automatically fair. You're not depending on me to see you and call on you. You just get into the line, and when it's your turn, you ask your question.
So you mentioned the categorization, which I thought was a very interesting point. But I'd like to pick you up on that. And my second thought when I heard that was, well, how do you categorize?
It's an objective judgment. It's not something that the author designates. If someone writes a program, he's not allowed to say, I consider my program an artistic work. Because a judge will say, no, this is a program. But what about what about borderline cases? Borderline cases should get treated as the in the category that gives the public the more freedom. Which means if you are writing something and you don't want it to fall into that case, it's up to you to make sure it doesn't. Make sure it's not a borderline case. What about if a work combines aspects of both? Well, then it has to go into the category that gives the public the most freedom. If you don't want that, separate them clearly. And then one part, say, can be a work of functional use, and another part can be art, and each part gets treated as what it is, if you've made a clear separation that can be used. But if you just mix them all up together, it's going to have to be treated as a functional work. Because we can't let you impose restrictions on a functional work by putting in some art.
So how does the judge decide on what category it should be in? So the example is
there's no need to answer that here.
Okay. I thought you maybe had a
this is what judges are for. They figure out those details. That's the point.
So an example would be maybe a text font, which you mentioned is clearly a functional use, but I've seen fonts which I'd clearly say are works of art.
Well, yeah, those are probably display fonts. That's why I said text fonts, because display fonts are a somewhat different issue. So, yes, I agree. And judges are going to have to make that distinction, just as they make dozens of other such distinctions applying today's copyright law.
Thanks.
So we should not be fooled by the dishonest argument that there can't be any distinctions. Copyright law is full of distinctions, and some of them are not obvious how to make, but courts have to make them anyway.
Okay. You told us about this scheme, how you could divide a flat rate for among certain actors or other.
You can find it at mecenat-tradeunion-global.org.
Can you explain how the technical part of a production would be financed through that?
I don't understand technical.
I mean, the people who produce a CD, for example, or the cameraman who works for a movie. I mean, how does he get his money?
I suppose that the artists would have to pay them. Fortunately, it's getting cheaper all the time.
But do you really believe that an artist could find enough
money for,
to produce his own
they
CD
do this.
All by himself?
Of course they do. What world are you living in? I mean,
I don't know.
30 years ago, they couldn't. Today, they do. Today, it's normal. In fact, musicians will make CDs long before they get any chance to get any record contract.
Yeah, of course, but I mean, if a musician wants really to produce a good CD, he needs certain technical standards. And he cannot do this by himself in his garage.
Well, I think that they probably won't start doing that until they're somewhat successful and bringing in the money to cover it.
Okay.
These sorts of things are the things that basically the system adapts to one way or another. The current system has adapted to copyright law. That doesn't mean it can't adapt to different law.
Hi, I have two things. First of all, the good news, I've heard the PS3 has been cracked like 1 or 2 weeks ago.
Oh, really?
Yeah, it should be open by now.
Could you email me more information about this?
Absolutely.
Thank
I'll,
you.
I'll mail you the Slashdot post with all the comments.
I don't want the comments. I don't want to I don't want to spend an hour reading.
Okay.
I want the information I need to know.
Okay, I'll mail you.
Thanks.
The second thing, you have talked about forbidding DRM. The Pirate Party of Switzerland has picked up on that, and it's in their platform, and I respectfully disagree. Please assume I would be the license holder of a large portfolio of, say, music, of hundreds of artists, whatever. And I wish to give access to that music to people for a low cost. Say
I'm not impressed at all, because I don't think you're doing people any favor by giving them a low price in money and a high price in freedom. Yes, there are fools who will think that that's a lesser price, but I don't want you to be able to drive in the edge of the wedge and convert society to digital handcuffs.
What if it's clearly stated in whatever contract you agree to that you're only renting the music?
I don't want the sale of music to be replaced by rental of music. That's another attack on our freedom.
It's better than radio. It's worse than owning it. But
no, it's not better than radio. You can record from radio.
Well, as long as there are no legal protections for my digital protection,
legal?
You can crack it.
Well, if we crack it, then it will be okay.
Okay,
but if we crack it, you might as well not put on DRM. So really, there's no excuse here. Now, there's a small difference between what I've said today and forbidding DRM outright. I've said that conspiracies among companies to restrict the public's access to technology should be a crime. Now, once in a while, a single company does impose DRM, and that's still bad. I don't know if that should be a crime, but they probably shouldn't be allowed to do it, because the effect is harmful. And I am not one of those worshippers of the invisible hand who believes that if the public goes along with it, that means it's okay. The fact is, companies with a lot of money can organize to push or herd the public in a certain direction, and that doesn't mean it's okay.
You say you believe in freedom, but why should there no? Why should there not be any freedom for me to only
to
sell
take away
temporary
other people's
access?
Freedom? I don't care. Basically, I'm not concerned about your freedom when it conflicts with our freedom.
Okay.
I have one question too, and that is, I've run across this criticism of your copyright proposals, and I wonder what your response is. And the criticism is that your philosophy and the proposals you come up with require us to figure out the exact details of the benefit that the works do. You come up with a classification of works that need to be verified and judged on the more...
Well, I think most of the time it'll be totally obvious.
Fine.
I don't expect it to take much work.
Right, but
once in a while there will be... You see, because the nature of the system is that the people who make the work want it to be clear which category the work is in. They don't want to take a risk that it won't be clear, because if it's not clear, the decision might go against them. But if they make sure that it's clear, then they know what the result will be.
Yeah, I get that. But still, you grind through the details of the copyright phase. You tell us how long exactly it takes that the copyright lasts. You go through exactly how long it takes the publishers to have the print cycle. You go through a lot of details here. What people side of the spectrum appreciate is when things kind of run by themselves, when the baker provides the bread because it serves its own interest.
I'm afraid I don't follow you. You're criticizing something that in which my proposal is no different from existing law, and that it states how long copyright lasts. I mean, this criticism makes no sense at all. It's not coherent.
Might be. The criticism is that your proposal goes through too many details where...
Not true. It doesn't go through... Copyright law is very complicated. What I'm saying is very simple by comparison. Even if we add all the complexities in my proposal to the complexities in existing copyright law, that is, supposing it doesn't replace any of them, suppose they're all added complexities, it's nothing compared with what there already is. And I think some of them would replace existing complexity, which means they wouldn't add. So they're just mistaken. Maybe they don't appreciate how complicated copyright law is now. They've got this false picture of something totally simple, which my fairly simple proposal would replace. And then they're putting the priority on the wrong thing, which is absolute total simplicity rather than getting good results.
I'd like to pick up on a comment that you made that one should never use software as service. And I'd like to make a parallel with a couple of other things you've actually mentioned as good things, like when the printing press age, the printing press service was a good thing for the author. And also, you mentioned that if I have an object in my hand, there's no obligation of the vendor to actually sell me all the blueprints of that object. And so in that sense...
No, actually, I didn't say anything about that.
No, you
what I said was that...
It would be great if you could let me finish the sentence.
But I didn't say that.
Well, you didn't say it's a mandatory thing. So now I would like to get you clarify on this.
Well, why... Okay, I don't particularly care whether he sells me the blueprints because there's nothing useful I can do with them. If I get a program, if I get the source code of the program, I could change that. And even if I didn't know how to program myself, I could hire someone else to change it for me. And then you can compile the changed source code into an executable I can run. But there's no way to compile a changed blueprint into a modified product I can use. And because of that, the blueprints are not as useful as the source code is. Now, that may change someday. And if it changes someday, my conclusion will change too. If someday we have assemblers that we use to make all the physical objects we use, and these assemblers are controlled by plans, then yes, it'll be vital for those plans to be free and for us to get the plans to our objects, just as we now demand the source code for our software. That with those assemblers, the two issues will become very similar. But they're not very similar now with the technology that's actually used to make these physical objects. And then you mentioned compared the use of the printing press with the use with software as a service, but they're very different. You see, because software as a service means you do your own computing in someone else's server. Publishing is a different thing. That's not software as a service. So a better analog of the printing press today would be a blogging site. I don't see any problem with blogging sites. That's not software as a service.
But using a physical object to accomplish my needs and put value on
you're
top of my knowledge.
You're just generalizing so much that everything looks like the same issue, and it shows it's a mistake to generalize that much. I'm sorry, the statements I've made are more specific. I don't have anything to say at that totally general level because all the relevant details about which I'd want to comment are lost when you abstract that far.
Okay.
Okay, thanks. Any more questions? I have also one. As I mentioned, we have founded this politicians group, this cross-party group called Digital Sustainability. So, as you're very clear and precise on terminology, I would like to ask if you have thought about the term digital sustainability.
No, I haven't. But I am worried that the term sustainability might be used as an excuse to prioritize the fictional idea that artists are being paid through copyright and be used to defend existing copyright. I want to support artists, and that's why I've proposed various ways to support artists while respecting the freedom we need to have. And that sustains, that could sustain art. But sustainability seems like, I'm just worried that the word seems to lend itself to the other side.
Okay, thanks. We need to clarify this. So.
I would rather focus on the issue of freedom. To share. Because sharing is good.
Absolutely. Well, in Switzerland, we are very free minds, so freedom is a natural thing to us.
So, you know, we could say freedom on the one hand and supporting artists on the other are two compatible goals.
Sustainability.
But I wouldn't use the term sustainability for either of them. But, you know, you could do this and call it sustainability. I just think it's not the best word to use to make this point clear.
Okay. So if there are no more questions, we just would like to warmly thank Richard Stallman for his great talk and also discussion.
So, please... please take the stickers. These stickers are gratis. Please take as many as you know how to make good use of. That's what they're for, to be taken and used.
Okay, just before you leave.
Yeah. And then there's the protest
exactly.
That we're going to have. We're going to be leaving from here at 12:45, is that it?
Yep.
We're going to march to where?
Waisenhausplatz, it's called. And then we... see who is there, the press.
And then we give out handouts, and yeah. We have some signs.
Exactly, the signs.
It's a protest against the Berne Copyright Convention. When I was invited to give a speech here, I realized I couldn't come here and fail to protest this unjust treaty.
Exactly. So the Bernese PhD students were very active. They created nice protest banners. So please take a picture. And we will march through Bern to protest against the Bernese Convention. So please stay here until 12:45 and then we will leave. See you later.
And we still have pins and key rings and buttons for sale on behalf of the Free Software Foundation.